Okay, I'll proceed with roll call. Ward one, Mr. Rodriguez.
Present.
Ward three, Ms. Hunter. It appears Ms. Hunter is absent. Ward four, Mr. Andrews. Ward four, Mr. Andrews. Let's see, Mr. Andrews, looks like you're muted. Ward five, Mr. Clark.
Present.
Ward six, Ms. Pollitt.
Here.
Okay, Mr. Andrews, can you hear and respond? Okay, it looks like he does have his hand raised. Okay, we do have a quorum.
The first item on the agenda appears to be a review and possible approval of the February 2nd IAPC meeting.
This is Commissioner Pollack. I'd like to move that we accept the meeting minutes from February 2nd as written.
Do I have a second?
I'll second that. This is Mark Rodriguez.
Motion has been made and seconded. Do we have a vote? Are there any discussions? I'm sorry. Hearing none, will the commissioners vote on the motion?
You want to just all in favor?
We'll need a roll call.
Okay, we can do a roll call vote. Mr. Clark.
Aye.
Ms. Pollitt.
Aye.
Mr. Rodriguez.
Aye.
Mr. Andrews.
Stain.
That's four ayes. Any nays? Okay, motion passes 4-0.
Do we have a staff update?
I'll be happy to provide an update. Jeff Yates, Business Services Director. So what we have is we are finishing our single audit. It is complete. It's winding its way through the signature process at this point. So congratulations to Vivian and the team. That'll complete the work set for the expenditure implementation report. That'll close finally the FY 2021 fiscal year. As we get ready to move through and finish the 22 year, staff will start preparing some of the year-end entries as well as the reconciliations and so forth necessary so that we can hopefully be earlier in our annual comprehensive financial report than we were this year, as we are aiming for that 120-day window. So that's really where we are. I believe as soon as the single audit is finalized and signed off on, we will then provide that to you, and we'll be happy to answer questions about that at a later meeting. Vivian, do you have anything to add to that? I heard you through the wall, but you said you do not.
Sorry. So, yep, I do not, Jeff.
Those are the big updates. Of course, budget process is beginning and getting started in earnest and so forth. So we have a lot going on with the ERP implementation. So Workday software continues working through the chart accounts and the financial planning model module of that and so forth. So I'm sure as we kind of have some discussions, we'll talk more about that at a later date. I'll be happy to answer any questions, or that completes my update, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is the code enforcement subcommittee update. Do we have an report?
Yeah, I'll be happy to give you that report. This is Chairperson Pollack for that subcommittee. We had our last meeting last month in February, and during the meeting, we discussed how we were going to be determining the sampling and the random sampling. So we're at the point with the code enforcement audit where now we're going to start looking at code cases and gathering information about the various cases. And Mr. De La Torre presented, and Aaron Williams presented a methodology on how to approach that. And it looks like we're going to be taking a sampling of different types of cases, whether it's weeds, junk motor vehicle, zoning, whatever it might be. And they broke down the amount of, so we're going to start with 100 case sampling, and it's going to be percentage-wise related to the percent of code cases for all these different types. And then we're going to start reviewing those cases and see what we come up with. So I think we won't know until we look at the 100 cases. Are we going to know if we came to some conclusions about what we're looking for? We also reviewed the scope of the code enforcement audit so we could get reminded about, you know, what the purpose was. But we'll be looking for compliance to the code enforcement staff, basically following their own procedures, and then look at timeliness and some other things that were topics of the scope. So anyhow, we right now, I believe, Aaron is creating a random sampling of the cases for us, and it's going to be a listing. And then when he's done with that, he's going to get back in touch with us, I think, and we'll figure out when the next meeting is going to be. It's not yet set. Hopefully we'll have another meeting in the not too distant future here in March. And then we'll decide how it is we're going to start sampling those cases, whether we're going to do it remotely or in person. And that's my update. Does anybody have any questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your report, Ms. Pollack. Item 5 on the agenda is the police department response discussion.
Hey everybody, I'm Lieutenant Mike Allen with the Tucson Police Department. I'm going to talk a little bit about our call response, how we dispatch calls, how many calls come into the center, and how we kind of prioritize each of those calls. I'm going to share my screen for a very short PowerPoint. Can everyone see my screen?
I can.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Sometimes you never know with these. All right, so this is, again, this is going to be about call response priority, the method and policy. This, because of staffing down at the Public Safety Communication Center, we're kind of in a state of flux. We're trying to figure out the best way to handle some call load, some dispatching stuff with their limited number of dispatchers. And then, of course, we have some staffing considerations on our side at the police department. So we'll go into that as well. So for kind of reference for workload from 2021, 2020 and 2019, this is the total number of events for a year. And an event is basically just for those that don't know, an officer did something, whether that be a 2 or 3 minute traffic stop to a 12 hour barricaded subject call. Each of those would be an event. It had an officer actually respond and do something outside of just a 911 call. So every year the call center averages about 1.5 million calls, whether that be incoming calls into the center that need to be filtered out to either medical calls, or that could also be follow-up calls where the dispatcher is being requested by the officer to make a follow-up call or to call somebody back to get clarifying information. There's about 1.5 million calls in and out of that center every year, which leads to about those 500,000 calls where an officer actually has to go and do something. Tucson Police Department and the public service communication has moved to a thing called CBD. It's computer-based dispatch, sometimes also known as ECBD, electronic computer-based or criteria-based dispatch. And basically, it's just a new way of trying to figure out what is the most important thing that the dispatcher or 911 call taker needs to get right off the bat to determine what kind of response needs to be had and the priority of the response. It basically looks at the big questions first and then moves along to the kind of the minor details. It helps them to sort out what is life-threatening by basically the first questions they ask is whether or not a weapon's involved, what's the time element, and then begin getting some suspect information. Here's kind of a look at our current TPD patrol staffing. This isn't total officers on the agency. This is just what's assigned to handle some of those 500,000 plus annual events. It's about 45 sergeants working the four divisions. We're authorized 515 officers to handle those calls. We're currently at about 387, which is about 128 vacant. CSOs, that was part of the initial request. So I went ahead and included a little bit about CSOs because I think they are a very valuable asset to us. We currently have 54. However, we have 28 in the academy. I'm sorry, 26 that just graduated this week that hit the field that are not in there. And then we have 28 officers currently in the academy. So one of the biggest issues that we face is attrition. We're averaging about 7.33 officers per month that are attriting. Over the last 6 months, that's 44. An academy class takes about 4 months for an academy class plus several other months of training to get them to a point where they are a solo officer. So as you can imagine, when we have those 28 officers in the academy, we will lose well more than that 28 in the time it takes to get them out there. So it's a battle we're having quite a bit right now. And I know you've got Sergeant Howell from recruiting who's going to be speaking here in a couple weeks, so she can talk a little bit about the recruiting efforts. So it's probably a good segue. The call priority system, it really runs from level 1 through 9. We don't really use the 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 for the most part right now. We do a little bit, but that's mostly just when the dispatcher is unsure about how to classify something. She may put it out as a level 9, and then that leaves it up to the field sergeant to decide where it needs to go based on staffing and based on just kind of the area or information he or she may have. So level 1, that's our highest priority. That's basically an imminent threat to life that we've got to get to right now. There's most likely a weapon involved. Level 2, Could be possibly a fight where somebody might have a bat or maybe said to have had a weapon, and there's a potential for that to turn violent, you know, pretty quick. So level one's the highest two. We've got to get there before it becomes a level one. Level three is kind of the run of the mill. It's currently a crime that's occurring against a person, or it's going to be some kind of significant property damage, maybe like burglary in progress. And there's a high likelihood that we're going to be able to get out there and capture a suspect still in the area. Level fours usually come out when somebody, you know, comes home from work and they realize that their house was broken into sometime after they left, or they realize something was taken from their business and that suspect is no longer there. Time is not of the essence for us to get out there. So that gets categorized as a four. A lot of the level three calls for services, if too much time goes by, this field supervisor will end up downgrading those to a level four because we're not going to capture anybody if a certain amount of time goes by. So when I said everybody's in a little bit of state of change, currently for dispatch, which kind of dictates how we dispatch our calls, how we handle our calls and the call priorities, the city is broken into four divisions, teams 1, 2, 3, and 4. Currently, team 1 and 2 are combined on a single frequency with a dispatcher. That dispatcher handles both of those frequencies. Teams 3 and 4 are also combined with yet one more dispatcher. And then there's either a third dispatcher or another employee who's trained down at COMO that is stationed on a position where they are like an info channel. So this is a huge change from what we're used to since I've been on for almost 17 and a half years. It used to be that we had a single dispatcher for each of the four divisions. And so if you were in team 2 and you had a call in team 2, only team 2 officers would hear what was going on in that division. All of your resources were under one dispatcher. As it is now, because of their staffing, they had to go from 4 dispatchers to 2 full-time, 2 dispatchers at any given time. And if there's a third, they'll be on that info channel. And that info channel is basically, if the officer is out with a subject and they feel that it's safe to do so, they'll switch to that info channel to run the subject or to run a license plate or to request some kind of follow-up or request a different unit or some kind of resource. They'll take that radio traffic off of their primary frequency onto that third frequency to do that, and then come back, because as it was with just the four divisions, those dispatchers were getting kind of overworked and there was a lot of radio traffic with just a single team on each frequency. And now you've got 2 frequencies on each channel. With that and the extra level of responsibility that each dispatcher has with that extra traffic, we move to a self-dispatching model. And basically, if it's a level 1 or level 2, it'll be on the dispatcher to delegate to the officers and to physically dispatch those officers and whatever resources based on the call to that call. If it's a level 3 or a level 4, the officer, it's upon the officer and the field sergeant for that officer to go, I will take that call, and I either need another unit to come with me or I don't. And then the officer will physically take control of that call off the board without the dispatcher having to take it from her screen and dispatch it to the officer. This ties up some radio frequency, kind of gives everybody a little bit of, you know, makes everybody do a little bit of initiated activity. And then if you don't know, each division is broke down into sectors or chunks. There's typically 7 sectors in each division. And we try our best to have every sector with an officer assigned at any given time. Due to staffing, that does not occur. So what gets tricky, as you know, driving around in Tucson, the traffic can get pretty outrageous. Officers try to typically stay in their sector, because if they've got a 20-minute drive, round trip to go to, just drive time to go take a call in another sector, that's 20 minutes they're not in their sector. So there's a little bit of what we call sector integrity, where officers try to clear up their sector, handle everything in their sector, which makes sense because they know the beat, they know the people, they know the routes. But if they have to, they will clear to go take other calls in other sectors based on that priority system that we talked about. The ones and twos really don't matter for sector integrity. They're going to go and they're going to take those wherever. But the threes and fours, it's kind of implied that you'll try to clear up your sector and any case reports will happen there. The role of CSOs, this was, like I said, this was initially mentioned. CSOs are our saving grace right now. They're one of the greatest resources that we have as a community and as a police department. Community service officers are responsible primarily for those lower priority call response types. And these are typically where there's no suspect. There's no chance of any kind of a fight or argument or anybody getting roped into anything. They also will go and do burglary reports where they actually have a little bit more time to take fingerprints, to spend some time canvassing neighborhoods and talking to neighbors. They'll go to collision investigations, traffic hazards when the lights go out in the monsoons. These guys are a great resource. They also do our park patrol. Those are CSOs that are doing the park patrol. They also assist with our front desk duty, which is answering calls that come into the station and then making phone calls back to different people who requested a call at a later time. This is a big change from when they were initially hired on with the city 30 years ago. They mostly just answered phones at that time, and they've really evolved into, you know, they wear the uniform, they're out there, they're assisting the officers. You know, the more CSOs we have handling those low priority calls, realistically, the less officers we need, because the officers can then just respond to the level one and level two calls where you need somebody in uniform with a gun. You know, the more dangerous scenarios. Several things have changed recently. Again, with the staffing and the changes through Chief Kazmar, I was assigned down to communications for about a week, working on some of these changes with the dispatching. There was quite a concern about how well those were going to be received with both the officers and the communications staff. I could say I was blown away at how understanding both the officers were of the situation down at communications, and that the communications staff were just, their biggest concern was, is this going to get an officer hurt? How is this going to play out? So everybody actually listened to each other. And that really speaks volumes to Chief Kazmar when he was down there, how he got that all turned around. There's some different ways that we could be using CSOs. I'm hoping we get to that point here in a little bit. Right now, they're really just backfilling some of those roles of the officers that we're short on. But in our most recent contract, the CSOs have been kind of given a little bit more opportunities to do different things other than just take those level four calls. We've got some that are assigned down to our vehicular unit, which investigates fatal collisions. They're helping process vehicles that we take during a fatal collision. They're helping with a whole bunch of different things that they never had the opportunity to do, which is really a really good way to recruit them and get them on if they know that there's some movement, some lateral and up and down movement as well. That's kind of how we dispatch and kind of the state of our dispatch and our priority system. I don't know what everybody knows, but I'm willing to take some questions.
Do we have any questions?
Officer, yes, this is Commissioner Rodriguez. I think that was an excellent report, sir. And I commend the new chief with the mayor being on the same page. We've seen that on the news. There's a couple of concerns that I want to just put out, and maybe you could address those or give us some feedback. There's a couple of things. I know that recruitment is a big issue. I understand that the salaries have gone up. I'm hoping that is sufficient. Also with the benefits, it is a tough job in keeping our community safe. The role of the community service officers, I'm just wondering, this is one of many questions I have, and I'll try to make it brief. If they are assigned, when you have your, let's say, level one or two or three cases, where there's a situation where you have a mental health issue, and it just would probably need more of a mental health crisis team or Are the CSOs being trained for that, or what is the situation with those calls when you have someone that is not, could be a threat, but more a threat to himself? And what is the current situation with that? And do you have your CSOs properly trained for that?
Yeah, so a lot of our CSOs have gone through crisis intervention training, more just to know when they're dealing with somebody, if they're in crisis, and how to approach that, and how to keep themselves safe. However, no, they do not respond to level one and level two suicidal calls, because based on that criteria of dispatch, that's somebody with a weapon that's actively going to harm someone or themselves. And we're not going to send that CSO there with no tools, because once they're there, if they needed a tool, they wouldn't have the tool. If they needed a gun or a taser, they don't carry all of the tools that they would need to protect themselves. So the best thing that we can do is have them available for the burglary calls and the collision investigations and all of those things that are very tedious and time consuming, so that the officers with those tools and the extra training are available for those calls, so that we get there a lot quicker.
Would you, in a situation, call them to a situation like that to assist you, or would that be separate? Let's say you come to a scene where the person is that, but then it's secured. Would there be a follow-up with the CSOs on that?
If we went to a level one suicidal where a subject had a gun to their head, would we call the CSOs at some point during that? Is that what you're asking?
Right. I know we've had some situations here with domestic violence situations where, unfortunately, people are killed. I'm just wondering what the process would that be for follow-up?
Yeah, we would not have the CSOs in anything domestic violence related or suicidal subject related or armed robbery related. Nothing where there's a threat of violence would we put somebody without those tools in that situation.
I see. So they're not specifically armed. I can assume then that the police themselves are definitely trained for that, and we'll follow up on that. It's just my concern and our neighborhoods of, you know, what comes up after that. Unfortunately, the level of violence is, in some cities has increased, and I think safety of the community, individuals, our police force also is important. But are there any recommendations you have for possible further recruitment or possible, you know, how we can better retain our police force and CSOs?
No, Chief Kazmar's, he's firing on all cylinders right now, luckily. So we did a really good job of getting those raises. That was a big sticking point with a lot of people who had gone many, many years without a raise. That the problem is every agency has kind of gone through some iteration of getting those raises. So as close as we thought we were to getting closer to market, we're having that issue again, where the people we were trying to catch up to took another step. So we're being competitive for the first time in a long time. I've seen lateral officers. It was only three, but those are officers that are already trained. Somebody else has already paid for that training, and they actually came to us. That's a huge change from what we were used to, from where we were paying to train all these officers. And then those officers were leaving for other agencies. We're starting to see other officers come to our agency. Some of the stuff that mayor and council have put forth and the city manager with the tuition reimbursement, I took full advantage of the tuition reimbursement for about 3 years to the tune of about $15,000 to get my bachelor's degree. That was a big deal to me. And now with the loan repayment for school loans, I see that as another great tool. I've never, since I've been here, ever seen 26 CSOs come out at one time. I mean, that we're increasing our CSOs by about 25-30% in one class. People really like the CSOs, you know, the community loves them. they're available. They have the opportunity to take a little bit more time on some of these lower priority calls, but these are the calls that most people are going to deal with when they get in a collision and they want to see somebody from the police department come and respond or help them get a tow truck. The CSOs have that amount of time to spend and to do it right, because they're not worried about a level one priority where somebody's life is at risk, where they've got to cut the community member short on the burglary or something else. They can actually spend that more time, quite a bit more time with them, so the officers can stay freed up for the other things.
That's great. That's wonderful progress. I commend you all on that. I have a few more things regarding that in the recruitment and the retention. I know it's important to have a diversity of all races and backgrounds for the police force to reflect our community. I know that is a big issue, but also being addressed. I've talked to some neighbors, and they're saying in other cities, states, I think they recommend that the police live in the areas that they serve or in the city that they serve. One of the big concerns are policemen that live outside of the city are not familiar with in city. Recommendations or what do you see as being addressed with that issue?
So we do not have a requirement to live in the city. I can tell you, I do not live in the city. If that was a requirement today, you'd probably lose 50 or 60% of the officers that we have, because most do not live in the city. They live in the county. You know, we've been poaching and trying to get officers from Marana and Oro Valley to come to us. I don't think that would be a beneficial recruiting or retention concept whatsoever. I can tell you, I've been on 17 years. I was born and raised in Tucson. I've never left Tucson. I'm very familiar with Tucson. A lot of my family lives in the city of Tucson. I just happen to live on the outskirts because that's more my style than traffic. So I don't see that as a viable option or something that we would ever push.
Well, that's a little concerning. I've been born and raised third generation here. And in talking to the neighbors and people here that I know, to have people that are from Tucson, understand the issues of Tucson, the city, outside city boundaries, you talk about different, possibly more affluent areas. That don't necessarily reflect all of the character of Tucson. That's a concern. The other I would hope is just the issue of diversity, of reflecting the ethnic constituents of Tucson. So those two issues are a concern, but just something for you to understand. It's one of my concern and one of a lot of the neighbors and colleagues that I have. But let me go on to something else because I want to move on the agenda. In the issue of background checks, I'm particularly concerned also with who are you recruiting for that, if there's any questionable right-wing affiliations. I do understand with the Southern Poverty Law Center that a lot of the alt-right forces tend to recruit and ask them to go into the military and go into the police force and maintain their alt-right views, many of them racial. And we've got some serious issues here in the United States and also in the U.S., and especially with insurrection. Unfortunately, it was being a veteran myself, I was dismayed of the amount of veterans and law enforcement that were part of the insurrection. That was very disheartening. I'm a second generation veteran, and I hate to see that kind of fascism portrayed. That's a real issue that goes all the way down to the neighborhoods. So that's a concern of mine. In your recruitment efforts, do you do a sufficient background check of individuals that have been involved online or recruited or being part of any alt-right history?
If I could interject real quick, Lieutenant Allen, Commissioner Rodriguez and Chairperson Mr. Clark, we do have, just as a reminder, we do have the recruitment on the agenda for next month. This agenda item is for call responses, so we want to keep the discussion to kind of the boundaries of that item. We don't want to get too far off topic since we don't have it on the agenda to speak about recruitment that much.
Okay, well, I understand that. I just thought it was an excellent report by the officer. I think it's a great progress, but being that it is on next month, I look forward to that. That is a major concern for a lot of us in many states.
And if so, I could interrupt, I think Commissioner Polak has a question, had her hand raised.
You know what? My question was more about, it wasn't about 911 responses. It was another topic for TPD. So I'm just going to refrain from asking that because I don't want to go off on another tangent off on my tangent.
Thank you, Commissioner. Brian Andrews also has his hand raised.
Yes, thank you, Vice Commissioner, Vice Chair Clark. Lieutenant Allen, I was wondering if there are any requirements of the community service officers that law enforcement officers have for like state sanctioning, or if they're more of an administrator, and if you could talk about the process of hiring a CSO versus an officer, and if it is much easier, and if the pay ranges are attractive. And you had mentioned that this might be a solution for some of the shortages of officers. And then a secondary question is, aside from pay, building the force numbers up, are there other things that the city is considering other than pay that are attractive to recruits to the police department that might help with call response? And I'll listen. Thank you.
Sure. So let me try to dive into this a little bit. It is much easier to hire a community service officer than a police officer. The background investigation is almost the same, though. And to not go too far into it, because the recruiting and people will be here and they do the backgrounds, but it is social media. They check social media posts. They see what's being posted on social media by the recruits. They do a standard background check. They're running these CSO officers. The benefit, though, to this is we're able to capture these people at the age of 18 instead of at the age of 21, and get them involved in our city, get them involved with our department when they're 18, instead of waiting till they're 21, where they may have moved, joined the military, found something else to do. But if we can get them at 18 and make them a CSO until the age of 21, and they want to be an officer, we have a path for them to go from CSO to officer. And it actually works the other way as well. We've had many people that wanted to be officers that just didn't cut it. And we are more than willing, if we can, and it's appropriate in each situation, we will offer them a position as a CSO. And we've got a few right now in the academy that started off as an officer, didn't make it, went down to CSO for a few years, and then they're back in the police academy, going to give it another try to be an officer after they matured a little bit. They, you know, they worked on their writing, they worked on their, you know, their people skills. So once we have them and we've invested in them in either one of the training and the background and all the stuff that goes into getting them, we try to hold on to them, you know, as tight as we can and find them a way to stay with our agency. What was your second part of your question? Oh, pay. So in this last pay raise, CSOs were getting paid, as far as I'm concerned, they were getting paid like 15 or 16 bucks an hour, which is outrageous if we're going to pay, you know, McDonald's employees 15 for these CSOs that are, They're out there, they're working it. They're a lot of times they're in things that they shouldn't be in because the community and whoever wants to do harm, they just see a cop car with a person in a uniform and they really don't know what these people are out there doing that they're unarmed. So to pay them such a low amount was really an issue getting them onboarded. They've increased them quite a bit. They're like $20 an hour now, which has certainly helped. I'm sure that's why we ended up with 26 graduating this time. It's usually like 5 or 6. So that just shows you how astronomical that was. As far as the other question about things to do to retain and other things, a lot of the officers, I'll tell you the sentiment amongst the officers is they want to be treated well. They want to be at a place that is kind of like a family. Chief Kazmar has brought that to our agency. And people are just happy to come to work. And when people are happy to come to work, some of the money stuff and some of the other, you know, the nonsense, the political stuff, the news stuff, that kind of all gets drowned out by just they feel like family and they want to come to work. And Chief Kazmar has certainly brought that to our agency. And people are just happy. I was joking with him the other day at a retirement thing. He had done quite a bit. And I'm like, hey, man, are we trying to set some records here with retirements? But sometimes it's just a math problem where people leave because they were in the drop program or they were all hired in one big batch 20, 25 years ago. And now they're hitting milestones and leaving. But I see the attrition slowing down quite a bit through Chief Kazmar and through the city, the things the city is doing. With some of the benefits and the perks and the tuition stuff's a big one. We can now compete with the military for people if we have a tuition reimbursement and a loan forgiveness thing. We can be competitive in those.
Thank you.
I have a question. Going back to the response, this is Commissioner Clark. What training do the officers have when they're responding to a mental health crisis? Is there a kind of a uniformity among the training of the officers, or are there specialists?
Yes and no. There is a uniformity amongst every patrol officer. That's what the academy is for, where they have an entire block on dealing with people in crisis. Some get additional training where they attend crisis intervention training. And then above that, we have our MIS team. There's been many, many situations when I was a sergeant in patrol where we may have a suicidal subject who's alone in their house. It's not appropriate for us at that time while they're in crisis to send an officer to the door. So we'll try to reach out via telephone or we'll leave them a note or a business card and say, hey, when you decide you want to come out and you want to talk to somebody, you weren't answering the phone for us. Here's some resources for you to call. And not amp up those situations. And then we'll also follow up with our MIS team and say, hey, we were over at this house. This guy was in crisis. He didn't want to talk to us at this time. You know, maybe tomorrow morning you guys can try again and try to get him some services. So we have a lot of other things that we've been doing for many, many years, aside from just going to these level one suicidal with a gun calls and forcing an encounter. If they're alone in their house and they're suicidal, we're perfectly accepted. It's perfectly acceptable for us to walk away if they don't want our services, because all we're going to do is create a barricade situation where they're going to end up trying to commit a suicide by cop or forcing some kind of situation with the police department when there may be other people that are better suited to handle it. But at that time, a social worker is probably not the person that is going to go knock on the door when somebody has a gun. Sometimes some time and distance is the best thing, and getting them their resources at a later time.
Thank you. Commissioner Anderson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Clark. Lieutenant Allen, I was wondering, with the criteria-based dispatch and assigning levels to call responses, are there any records that track the efficacy of the prioritization of calls? For example, if the TPD dispatcher doesn't send an officer to, say, a noise complaint, are there follow-ups where an officer has to respond because calls have escalated to another level, say becoming violent thereafter? And are they tracking that? Does that help adjust the way they prioritize call responses?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. That's something that comes out of our communications division, which is a separate division from our agency. I'm sure there's a way for them to track how many times calls are upgraded or downgraded, but I would not say in that situation that there would ever be enough, you know, noise complaints that turned into a physical fight that we were going to upgrade every noise complaint, or it would just skew everything. If noise complaints went from, you know, let's say a level 4 to a level 3, now what is really a level 3? Is that now a level 2? And then are we skewing how many level 1s we have, and do we have enough cops to handle those? A lot of this really has to do with staffing and what can we actually get to in a reasonable amount of time, and what is more likely to occur. We know that the armed robbery suspect that's got a gun inside the Circle K right now, that's a level 1. Do we need to get that anywhere close to a noise complaint that may be a level 3 now, or the level 3 that's now a level 2? So it seems to be working on our end without any statistical data. We're barely getting to the calls we need to get to in the time we need to get to. So I can't see until staffing changes adjusting any of those call loads, because that's what we've been dealing with for a while and making it work.
Thank you.
Officer Olson, this is Commissioner Rodriguez again. I was wondering, in the recruitment and also you have the academy, does Pima College, or any of the community college or Pima College, do they have a program that might fit into your level of recruitment and retention there? I'm glad that there's reimbursement and also loan forgiveness, but I'm just wondering, is there through the public colleges, the Pima Community College, is there a specific program that could be developed, or is there one that could sort of just bring in more possible recruits for your academy for either police officer or COS?
Yeah, there's certainly, yes, there was one. I don't know. You'll have to talk to Lieutenant Howell when she comes on, if that's still in effect. And it was basically where you achieved a law enforcement type degree, which we would accept as having had completed the academy. However, that was not shaping up to produce the best candidates. Some of them were not physically fit, and once they ended up having to pass some of the tests, they were unable to do so. However, we do have a good. What's that?
I was wondering. Maybe that could be perfected or bright, made a little better to fit in with the requirements that your department.
I'm sorry. If I understand the issues, we're going to be dealing more completely with recruitment at a later session, and I don't know that we should involve the lieutenant in all of these.
Point well taken. I understand that. I'll wait for next month for more specific questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I do have a really good relationship with Lieutenant Howell, so I've taken some notes. And what I'll do is I'll send her kind of some of what you guys have asked me that I don't know, so that she has some of those answers and she doesn't have to do too much follow-up with you at a later time.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Officer Olson. Great job.
Are there any other questions of the lieutenant?
No, sir.
Hearing none, shall we move on?
Well, thank you guys for having me. I'm going to leave the meeting unless you need me for another part of this.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Have a good day.
The next item on the agenda is discussion of bylaw changes. Is everyone a copy of the bylaws?
I don't have a copy in front of me, but I do remember one of the concerns was possibly our meeting dates being on a Saturday, if that's pertinent to this topic, or if there's other topics.
Ms. Pollack? Commissioner Pollack, you have a question.
Yeah, I was the one who originally brought this up. And there's The bylaws are actually pretty simplified, but there are some specific things mentioned in there that could restrict people from being on the commission or cause the commission not to have a quorum. And we've had a hard time in the last year trying to find additional commissioners. And you know, of course, you never know why, you know, but so my thought was to maybe try to think about if some of these restrictions could be removed. So one restriction is the meetings are required to be held on the first Wednesday of the month. And they're required to be held at, I believe, 3 o'clock. I'm not looking at those bylaws, but I'm pretty sure it says 3 o'clock. And, you know, people work, and work the workday is still basically 8 to 5. And it is it's hard to find people who can, in the middle of, possibly even the middle of the week, be available at 3 o'clock on their employer's time clock. And so I was just wondering if it would be possible to open up that requirement, and you could still keep it unofficially on the first Wednesday of the month at 3 o'clock. But if people started to become unavailable or they weren't available at that time that week, you could pull people to see when they are available. Now, and then you could have at least the ability to change, to move it an hour or to move it one day on that side. I believe the bylaws also talk about the meetings being in person. And that is also impractical as far as, you know, you might live in at the edge of the city, whichever direction it is, north, south, east, west, and everybody has to come together downtown at the, you know, council chambers and meet for a meeting. Personally, since I've been on this commission since September of 2020, I think that everything we've done is perfectly capable of doing it remotely. And if I have to go to a meeting, it's going to be a hardship. And so, because I work. So I had spoken to Councilman Kozacik about to get his feelings on that, and he could always chime in, send a letter or whatever. But he also thought, well, maybe, you know, it was too restrictive to expect people to show up, you know, during working hours. And so, you know, a lot of commissions and heads of teams and neighborhood things and whatever your calling is, they rely on retired people. And retired people can't be expected to be running everything. And it's kind of ridiculous anyhow. We need people of every age, every level, every ethnicity. We need people to be involved in city government. And just opening up something like these bylaws may eventually lead to more involvement. So that's my thought on that. And the bylaws also say that we can vote on this at any time and it will take effect as of the that meeting. And so it's not a big drawn out process to do that. So anyhow, that's my thoughts on that. I don't see a reason personally not to change it, to open it up. And as I said, you know, we can still plan on the meetings where they're at until at which point people aren't able to come. The other thing you have to take into consideration is that city staff has to be available. And so that is a challenge because they work 8 to 5. And I know they put in, a lot of them put in a lot of after hour time. But, you know, maybe we can come to some kind of a happy medium. So anyhow, that's my thoughts on that.
Thank you, Commissioner Pollack. I have a question. Oh, I'm sorry. Someone has their hand up. I don't see who it is. Mr. Williams, Commissioner Williams.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. I can read the two pertinent pieces of the bylaws, since not all the commissioners have them in front of them. That way it might help frame your discussion a little bit. The Article 5, Section 3 is the one that states Section 2 of Article 5 states the regular meeting shall be on the first Wednesday of the month at 3 p.m. So then any adjustments you'll want to make sure are for that article in that section. I don't see any parts of the bylaws that address the method of the meeting. So virtual is fine. I don't see anything in there that says that they have to be in person. And then the last part to highlight is Article 11, Section 1 talks about how the amendments work, which is the topic that we're in right now. If the discussion goes there, an amendment to these bylaws may be proposed by any commissioner at any regular meeting. The proposed amendment will be placed on the agenda for the next regular meeting for approval. So it was mentioned at the last meeting, a possible amendment to the meeting times. So that is something that was announced and on the agenda this month. And then that same article, Section 2, is the proposed amendment will be voted on at the next regular meeting following the meeting at which the amendment was discussed. Section 3 then is an amendment properly ratified by the commission will become effective immediately unless the amendment provides otherwise. If you need that referenced again later on in the discussion, just let me know. Thank you.
Part of my question, I think, goes to the issues that Commissioner Pollack raised. As a vice chair, I have no problems with conducting a meeting, but I have a question as to the efficacy of our reports if we don't manage to staff our commission. As we're set forth, it looks like through the last couple of years, the reports have been made by the vice chair without a chairman. And I wonder what that does to our efficacy if we don't have a full staff. And of course, what Commissioner Pollack showed is that it's difficult to get a full commission because of the time that the meetings are set. So it does seem to be a problem, but I'm questioning whether the impact that the commission will have if we can't even staff it with a full staff of officers.
Commissioner Clark, this is Brian Andrews.
Yeah.
If you can hear me, I'd like to offer that prior to COVID, the meetings at 3 downtown were fairly well attended by a mixed group of individuals. We had some retirees, we had business people, and things seemed to go fairly well. I know there have been commissioners that have resigned for a variety of reasons, and it is a city council function to appoint commissioners. And I'm not sure that with a full effort, that would be difficult to find commissioners that are willing to serve. I'd offer that this might be something we want to consider once we return to a more normal state of business. I do know that when we meet in person, things such as writing reports and the collaboration that happens between members is far more efficient with a greater outcome when we're able to meet in person. And I've seen that on a number of subcommittees where we'll assimilate everyone's thoughts into reports, and it works very, very well. And while the current time might be inconvenient, it might be worth it to postpone action on changing a time when we get to a more normal state of conducting business, and then see what will work the best if we're going to pick another meeting time. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I think that's a good point too that was just made. And maybe there's a hybrid model that we can adopt. Some in person, some remote, depending on, you know, what you're trying to do. So I agree with you on trying to collaborate on like a report and things like that. Might be faster in person.
Commissioner Clark?
Yes.
This is Mark Rodriguez. I was wondering on that note, maybe, and having more background information, the feasibility of having city employees be paid on a Saturday. Is that an expenditure? Is that something that could happen? So we would have an idea if that's possible and whether city employees would be open to for that alternative model. It might be good to get some information regarding that, as well as the comment done earlier about keeping them at that time and the importance of, I also agree, is meeting in person does have an impact, but it's just a suggestion I have, is exploring the feasibility of and the cost of having city employees be available on a Saturday.
I can
speak. Do you have any ideas on that?
I can speak to it in general terms, Vice Chair Clark and commissioners. Availability of staff on weekdays or even weekends or weekdays after hours, after normal business hours, you'll see the availability of staff greatly decrease. So I would suggest that I agree with flexibility is good. The bylaws also allow for special meetings to be called at any time. But yes, if you move to something outside of normal business hours, the availability of staff to provide presentations like you saw today, those types of things will be drastically impacted.
Other comments?
I think I'd just like to say maybe we could just continue this, keeping this on the future agenda to monitor if we need to make a change. If that's possible.
Based on Aaron's comment, our efficacy as a commission would seem to require us to be able to present city employees and staff. And if it seems unlikely that we could have, it seems unlikely that if we had a reduction in our ability to bring forth staff to inform us as to the things we wanted to look at, then our function as a commission would be greatly reduced. I might suggest that each of us talk to our council person and see if they have any suggestions. I'm going to ask Mr. Fimbres to nudge the mayor and the ward two council person to appoint, so we at least have a full commission.
I think that would be a great idea. Last year, I personally wrote a letter to every council and mayor and the mayor's office who were missing, you know, appointees. I think I didn't hear back from one of them. And for some reason, it doesn't seem to be a priority, or it didn't at the time. And so, and really all I'm kind of suggesting is we have the flexibility to move the meeting the day. So Wednesday is right in the middle of my work week. I don't have a lot of Wednesdays, but I can't just think of myself. But if I could have a meeting on Monday or a Friday, or just the ability to move it around, I could probably be there more often. And that, but then, you know, it's the same problem. Every one of us probably has commitments. And, you know, so it's not just about one person. But without the commission being fully stacked with all of the commissioners, one person being gone now, well, if two people are gone, then you lose your quorum. We didn't have a quorum for about 6 or 7 months in a row from, I think it was September, or it was July through January this year, so, or through December. And so you can't do anything if you don't have consistent quorum going on. So that's just it's sad to see that. Because I agree with Commissioner Clark, we could really be doing some audits on city processes, but we can't do them because we don't have enough people. And I wasn't involved in the commission in the past, so I don't know if it was fully staffed, if there was a different viewpoint of what the commission does. But I hope, you know, writing the mayor and the council people who have openings would bring it to their attention. But it took 6 months to get two additional commissioners.
Well, for what it's worth, I was a member of the Independent Audit and Performance Commission from 2009 for 8 years. And during that time, we never had to avoid a meeting for lack of quorum. That was then, this is now. And of course we have COVID, which has obviously interrupted, excuse me, many of the abilities to go forward with the meetings. But I know that I'm going to ask my council person to see if he can nudge the other council members and the mayor to complete the staffing. And it would, I think, just be more efficacy if we had a chairman to present the reports to the mayor and council. Does anyone wish to bring the proposed change of date to a vote? I see someone is trying to get in, but we can't hear you.
Mr. Rodriguez, it looks like your mic is picking up. Are you trying to speak, or is that just background noise?
I think that's background noise. I at this point, I being a new commissioner from Ward 1, it had been a while since you all had met, and this is a new process. But I think we need further discussion. I could talk to my council person. I guess I'm a new product of the a new appointee. I'd just like to also see it go forward, as Commissioner Clark said. So I'm in agreement with that, but I'd like to hold off at this point.
Any other comments? Then shall we, Mr. Williams, shall we put this on the next agenda?
I will add it as a future agenda item, and we do have enough space. It looks like we have enough space on the next agenda to put it back on there, further discussion of proposed amendment to the bylaws.
Thank you. Shall we move on then to the fiscal reports?
Yes, I can discuss and frame this topic if you'd like, Vice Chair Clark.
I'd appreciate it.
All right, Commissioners, Vice Chairman Clark, this agenda item was to discuss the drafting of the internal or the Independent Audit and Performance Commission's report to Mayor and Council about the city's annual financial statements and single audit. We sent out the link to the annual financial statements and an example of a previous report that goes to Mayor and Council. Usually this is something that the IAPC does on an annual basis. It kind of summarizes whatever the commissioners chose to look at that year and gives a summary to Mayor and Council of what was looked at, what was questioned, and answers by staff. As of this point in time, the single audit is not published. It is anticipated to be published within the next week or two. So then for next meeting, you might have a more robust discussion on the annual report, the annual financial report, and the single audit. The single audit is going to have a lot of important information on what the external auditors looked at and any findings and corrective action plans that the findings that the auditors would have and the corrective action plans that management would have. So what I can do is, as soon as that is published, I'll send the link to the single audit. I suggest that the commissioners review the annual financial report, gather up any questions you might have, provide them to me in advance so that we can provide it to staff so that they can have a well-developed answer to your concerns. And that way the discussion around those concerns can have some meaning. And then we can quickly move to drafting a letter to the mayor and council, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 months. Like Mr. Clark had said, the commission, if we're not able to present these things, then it kind of diminishes what the commission is here to do. One of the main things is to review the annual financial reports, ask questions of staff, and provide something meaningful to the wards that appointed and to the mayor and council in general.
Any questions?
Yes, this is Commissioner Rodriguez. I think that this is a pretty involved process, and the financial statements are very important. I was wondering, in your annual report or in your financial reports, is there any possibility to use any interpretation of the statistical analysis be done in graph form, showing trends or anything like that? I know with a background in biostatistics, it was really helpful to see it also in graph form, seeing a trend or seeing how things increase, decrease, only specific to those topics where it would be beneficial. I was just wondering if that's a possibility in your reports, a descriptive in your descriptive analysis, some graphs where it was pertinent.
Commissioner Rodriguez, members of the council, commission, yes, I sent an email with the links and some suggestions on where to look for useful information. The management discussion and analysis section of the annual financial report is going to have, usually that's where a lot of the summarized citywide information is held. You'll see charts and graphs, you'll see comparisons against prior year. So that section, it's only a few pages long. You can really get a lot out of the annual financials by looking there. It will probably highlight some areas that you might have questions on. And also, what I didn't include in that email is the statistical section, which is at the end of the financial report. Traditionally, that also has a lot of good comparative analysis information that a lot of people use to do trend analysis and other things along those lines. So those two sections are where you can kind of dig in without getting lost in the actual like financial statements of every single fund. It will give you a good idea. And then if you want to look deeper into, say, I don't know, like Section 8 housing, you could look at that in particular in the actual financial statements. But the MD&A and the statistical sections, you can glean a lot of the information out of those two places.
Thank you. Could you email me those that specific area, please? I can't write it down at this point, but could you just email me that specific reference?
Or absolutely
to all of us, I guess.
Absolutely, I'll send out the link to the annual financial report, and it's in PDF form. I'll list out the page numbers. Both the document page numbers and the PDF page numbers will be slightly different because the document includes just the document pages. The PDF includes also like the title pages and things like that. I'll send that out again right after the meeting.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Are there any further questions or comments?
This is Brian Andrews, and I just wanted to say that I think it's a good idea if the single audit is released and that comes out, that we do compile our questions on the CAFR and the single audit together and send them to staff, as Mr. Williams suggested.
It's a good suggestion. Anything further? Hearing nothing, future agenda items.
Vice Chair Clark, I can list off the items that I currently have tentatively scheduled and the list of future agenda items to help frame the commission's discussion on the topic, if you would like.
Thank you.
Okay, for the April meeting, we have the stand-in item of staff update. We also have the code enforcement subcommittee update scheduled. We have discussion of a draft report to Mayor and Council of the IAPC's review of the annual comprehensive financial report and single audit report that we just discussed. So we have an agenda item for that. We also have for the April meeting, the fiscal year 2022 internal audit plan third quarter update. And we also have the Tucson Police Department recruitment process and status. All of those are for next month. The future agenda items we have listed are, again, the discuss changes to the Independent Audit and Performance Commission bylaws. We also have equity officer and equity office update. That one's been tentatively out there as a possible future agenda item for for quite some time. And those are the ones that I have on my list.
Any comments?
I've got a comment. This is Commissioner Pollack. Since I haven't been with this commission that long, I don't quite understand if we just happen upon topics for audits. But sometimes they're requested by the ward office. But since audits can be recommended by the commissioners, it just seems like we could be more effective if we somehow start brainstorming what we might want to do audits on. There's hundreds of city processes probably in multiple departments. And it seems like there's just, 100 opportunities to do audits. And so I personally would like to see some discussion about where we could benefit from having an audit. So if not requested by the board offices, maybe we could have a discussion in the future about how we might arrive at what we would like to audit. Because there's numerous opportunities for improvement. It's excellent to get updates from different departments, but I know there's a lot of opportunity out there for improvement, and that's part of what we should be giving feedback on to the city. Just a thought for that.
Anyone else? Aaron, you're going to have to help me on this. We've got a list of the things to put on the future agenda, but set those out for the next meeting? It seems like an awful lot to try and include in one meeting.
Yes, I'm sorry. My connection dropped off for a minute, so I missed a little bit of Commissioner Pollack's discussion. But what we have set for the April meeting is roughly an hour. The TPD discussion today went a little bit over what we anticipated. So I would schedule the recruitment one. I would expect that there were a lot of recruitment questions today. So we might schedule that for 45 minutes. Internal audit plan update should be a quick one with just about 10 minutes. So we do have a little bit of space in the April meeting to include another agenda item if you'd like. May is looking open and June is usually the June meeting. The commission will take some time to kind of finalize their report to mayor and council. And we also, the commission usually would do a 6-month activities report to mayor and council that kind of summarizes what the commission has looked at in the previous 6 months so that the mayor and council stays updated. That kind of fell to the wayside during COVID. So that usually takes up some time on the June meeting. But we do have enough space to fit additional items as directed by the commission. Would you like to add to April discussion a little bit additional time for discussion of future agenda items? That way you do have time to reach out to your various ward offices and see if they have projects or interest areas that they would like you to look at. Traditionally, some good things come out of that. A ward member might have some concerns that might not be on the radar of city staff, or even commit IAPC members until they ask for it.
Those are all good suggestions. Does anyone have any comment?
I think that would be an excellent idea to reach out to the ward offices, maybe one at a time or two at a time or something, to get some feedback on what their concerns might be.
This is Commissioner Rodriguez. I agree. I think this is a good process and to move forward. Thank you.
Aaron, would you set that up?
I will schedule the agenda item for next month's meeting. Does that allow all the commissioners time to reach out to their wards?
Apparently, there's no opposition.
All right, it will be
Commissioner, go ahead. I was just going to offer that I think a month is ample time. And I would say that to my fellow commissioners, we are an independent commission and we can select things to audit. And as you look at the CAFR, there may be things about city expenditures that trigger thoughts of maybe gathering further information to be audited later. You know, there's things in the city that have been large for a group like ours to tackle, but the transit system is a big consumer of city finances and may be worth looking into. So as you look at the CAFR, there's some good opportunity to identify things that might be worthy of audit.
This is Commissioner Rodriguez. I agree. I also, one of the concerns I also have is the breadth of work and the cost in doing audits, and how that reflects with the expenditures and resources of the city. Just as a newbie, I'd like to maybe get more information, some kind of mentoring regarding what would that mean, an audit, the specific financial and staffing issues of that.
I can also add that as a future agenda item. Commissioner Rodriguez, would you like to add the item about the cost of the external annual financial audit, or a discussion on the internal audit division of the city, or a discussion on as needed services, which are kind of piecemeal audits that the city might undertake, not related to the financial audit, but like special project audits?
Well, great. You dissected that real well. I think at this point, it would be all of that, just for our own information, for some of us who weren't that familiar in doing more extensive work like that. It takes a lot of time, resources, and I just want to be more in tune with what that actually would mean in just basically our time, city's time, our assets, things like that. So all of those three things you mentioned over a period of time, I guess, could be addressed.
Okay, I can add to the future agenda items overview of audit processes across the city, possibly for the May meeting. It looks like we have a lot of availability then.
That sounds good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Aaron. Does anyone have anything else to present at this time? As I understand it, the next regular scheduled meeting would be Wednesday, April 6th at 3 p.m. Does everyone agree? There are no objection. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.